The European Patent Office podcasts bring you an insight into the technology and innovation shaping the world.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Talk Innovation. My name is Maria Kristjánsdóttir and I'm an attorney at LEX in Iceland, specializing in intellectual property law. I'm also the managing director of LEX's IP subsidiary, GH Sigurgeirsson. In today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Bergur Sigfússon. He is the head of CO2 capture and injection at the Icelandic company Carbfix. We will mainly be talking about how an intellectual property strategy can open doors to collaboration with reliable partners, whether it be in industry, academia, or even governments, and how it can help, how IP rights can help you scale up the operations and make them more efficient, as well as how this isn't always clear from the beginning of a company's journey. This episode is a collaboration between the European Patent Office and the Icelandic Intellectual Property Office. Hi, Bergur, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I thought to start off, we could go back to the basics, and I have maybe a threefold question. What is Carbfix, and why do we need to capture carbon? What problems does it solve? And why is the Carbfix approach so effective?
Carbfix is an industrial academia, let's say a project, a research project, which evolves about imitating and accelerating natural processes to store CO2 in the ground. And what we are doing, we are essentially doing the same thing that nature does to regulate CO2 levels by chemical weathering. Initially, it was mainly driven by PhD students and some academics. So they did the research in the laboratories and modeling. And then we at then Reykjavik Energy, we implemented the findings and tested them under field conditions. And since then, we have been scaling up our activities and are going into new industries. The reason why we are doing this is because we all know that CO2 concentrations are elevating in the atmosphere with the, let's say, the implications that we are witnessing every day in the news nowadays. What we can do by applying this method is that we can go to, let's say, industrial sources, for example, large emitters, and we can grab their emissions, dissolve the CO2 selectively in water, and then we inject that into the ground. Then what happens there is that we are essentially doing this at elevated pressure. So there is a lot of CO2 in the water, which means it has low pH. And this means that rocks, they dissolve rapidly. And by dissolving, there are selected cations that dissolve from the rocks. They bind with the CO2 to form stable minerals. So we are essentially locking the CO2 away forever. But there are also alternative ways of completing the cycle. And this is one thing we are working on with our collaborators, is to, for example, capture CO2 from large emission sources in Europe or the US. The CO2 can then be compressed, put into, for example, a boat, transported to a suitable storage site. And this, for example, is the case here in Iceland. So, and then we inject the CO2 into this location. Then the third alternative to do this is to simply capture CO2 directly from air. And this is what we have been doing with our collaborators of Climeworks for a few years, both on the demonstrations phase, demonstration states, let's say, and we have recently scaled up. And there we can just, or our collaborators can capture the CO2 from air. And this means that we are essentially working on emissions from everywhere. The CO2 is mixed in the atmosphere very rapidly, and it takes maybe a few days for the CO2 molecule to be emitted somewhere. It can travel across the globe, and we just collect it. So we have located these collectors in a good location, and then we can just capture it and then inject it into the ground.
Yes, thank you for this. It's very interesting. And I think maybe just for our listeners, I think we know the answer, but if you could just in as few words as you can, why do we need to control the level of CO2 in the atmosphere?
CO2 is a greenhouse gas. It is quite evident that that is the dominating factor of increasing temperature or elevating temperature in the atmosphere. With elevated temperatures, you get increased, let's say, severe weather events. You have elevated sea levels. You have differences in habitats and so on. So you are changing we are changing our conditions very often to the worse for large populations.
So essentially, by carbon capture, and if I understand it correctly, what you are doing is you are turning gas or carbon into rock, which mm-hmm. is quite amazing, I think, for someone who is not from the scientific side of things. It sounds a little bit something in a sci-fi movie, but it is amazing that we are actually doing this. Maybe as a follow-up question to this, if carbon capture is this essential tool or one of the essential tools to manage the global climate crisis, mm-hmm. it's interesting to know, I mean, what impact is it making already, the work that CarbFix is doing, and what impact does it need to make for the future?
Currently, we are just doing a drop in the ocean, and the combined, let's say, efforts of carbon capture and storage worldwide, it's also just a drop in the ocean. But what has been estimated is that approximately 100 or even more than 100 gigatons of CO2 have to be captured and injected in this way for the next 40 years. So it's quite a large scale that has to be dealt with. At the moment, the rate of capture and injection and storage is approximately 40 megatons per year. And this is the total effort of the world. And of that, CarbFix, we are doing nowadays maybe in the order of 20,000 tons. What we are doing is very small amount. The way we want to make an impact is to replicate the process. So we want to scale up in, let's say, manageable steps. We want to, of course, find the most cost-effective locations and collaborate with people that are, for example, emitting. And we want to bring our technology to them and offer them a solution to, let's say, decrease their emissions at perhaps a lower cost than they would otherwise have to pay, for example, for buying ETS quotas on the open market. So let's say this is the way we can scale up by offering something that is affordable, at least compared to other methods, or in this case, buying quotas.
And I imagine in this sense, in the upscaling, collaborations come into place. Mm-hmm. And in order to be able to collaborate, you would have to think about the IP and IP rights and how they connect into this. So if we move a little bit into what role IP and IP rights play in CarbFix, I have seen that your CEO, Edda Sif, she has said that IP is one of the keys to the future success of the company. What does that mean precisely, if you could elaborate a little bit about that?
Obviously, I'm not an IP specialist or anything. I'm just a humble geologist. But one thing that IP does, just in general, it gives, let's say, our customers confidence. We know what we are doing. That's one thing. But it also shows that we are serious in what we are doing. We are not selling something with no substance. We have made the effort of trying to consolidate our technology and protect it. Yeah, in very short, it builds confidence.
I think that's very interesting. And I think from the IP attorney perspective, I think it's really necessary that it is from the thought process from the beginning to have it in the strategic approach. You know, I think IP rights and patentability is so important to secure investments. So if you have it in the thought process from the beginning, that's more likely to succeed.
I mean, we didn't really think about this in the beginning. You have to maybe bear in mind, we started this process, 14 years ago now. So that's when CarbFix was initiated. One way of normal academic procedure is to do your research and you present your papers or publish your papers, get your PhD, and then you carry on and go doing something else. So it wasn't really formulated in the same sense as we are trying to provide the solution to help people.
If I understand this correctly, the IP perspective hasn't always been a part of the strategy. And it's interesting that it goes back 14 years. I think it must have been quite innovative at the time, as we have sustainability and climate crisis everywhere in the discussion now and in the past maybe 2 or 3 years. Has there anything with the IP path Have you started any paths that then have not worked? Or have you made any mistakes in this past, maybe, or not mistakes, but something that you have learned from?
Let's say it has definitely been a learning process. At the beginning of the project, I was not part of it. Actually, my supervisor was one of the founders of this, but I was then just doing my PhD on something completely different. But essentially, when they decide to start the project, they, in theory, the principle works because we know it works in nature, but it had never been done and nobody really had thought it through, you know, how are you going to do this? So there was an idea of the method, but nobody had done the whole thing. And it's just something that evolves over time. And then, okay, we test this initially in the field, under field conditions in 2011 and 2012. Then we start to understand better how all the different puzzles that need to come together to do this. And then it just evolves into being something that, you know, comprehensive, that is, let's say, patentable. We were not always thinking about, you know, going down this path of having a patent and doing the things like we do with them now. But one thing we perhaps realized is that, okay, we want to enable people to use this technology to, you know, do something good. While we are helping people to do these things, we also have to have some income because we have to, let's say, survive. The way we choose to go is to form like a subsidiary here around the project and with this aim of trying to secure our income so we can expand and spread. And having a patent is one puzzle in that, let's say, path.
Definitely. I think you hit the nail on the head, so to speak, on how IP rights are such an important tool on the path to sustainability, because all this new technology and innovation doesn't come for free. It takes years and years to research and develop.
Yeah, yeah.
And in order to do that, there has to be investment. By securing IP rights, they can be an insurance for the investors. If I can ask a little bit, we've mainly been talking about patents as the main IP rights, but there are, of course, other IP assets have a role in the sustainability path. I mean, I can mention trade secrets, design rights, and then trademarks, of course. And I do know that you have been quite diligent in obtaining trademark registrations for your trademarks, not only in Iceland, but around the world. Mm-hmm. As I see it, I mean, mainly trademarks, they can serve as to communicate that the product or service is green and sustainable. And can thus be a tool to spread out the word, so to say. Has that been your experience?
The increased exposure we have had over the last few years, it changes many things. And we have registered our trademark in different countries and so on. So we are visible in many of these countries. And we are, of course, we try to make sure that we show our identity to different news papers and so on. So we are always more and more in the, let's say, in the public domain. But one thing that this has led to and which has helped us is we are, of course, developing this technology, and we developed it in conjunction with a geothermal power plant. And we do it here in Iceland. And obviously, everything in Iceland in the big world is very small. We are few and far apart. We have small emissions. Everything is small here. So for us to approach different vendors of different technology, for example, compressors or whatever, they would very often just say, no, we are not interested. You're too small. And we would have to scale down our compressors to be able to service you. So, and this was especially relevant more than 10 years ago when we were starting. Essentially, nobody would talk to us. But nowadays, after our exposure, and we have worked on, let's say, the brand, you know, consistently for the last months and years, it is much easier. And now even when, you know, large international vendors are coming to us because we have built up this brand. And it ensures that we can do much more efficient capture process, for example, the injection process can be more efficient because we are now able to talk to, let's say, better suppliers, or we have more variety. So that is one thing that is very important for us. You know, so it's a, I don't know what comes first, but you know, we are building something that means we are approached by large vendors, which means we can build something even bigger.
That's a great example of how different kinds of IP rights all work together. Trademark to spread out the word, patent for a more technical part of the technology. And then, as I mentioned, other IP rights also play a part in this.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we have to our advantage, we mm-hmm. have the know-how. We have done this. We have been doing this for many years. So nowadays, it's much simpler for us to go into a process and just do it. Of course, when we did this the first time, we had an idea, or there was an idea in 2006. The project was formed in 2007. And the first ton of CO2 was injected in 2011. And then we went industrial in 2014. So it took 7 years to go, let's say, into proper application. When, once we have the experience, let's say, it is much easier. We had the idea of, you know, approaching the biggest landfill site in Iceland. And we had that idea last year. We applied for a research grant to do it, started that in February. And last week, we injected the first ton of CO2 from there. We have scaled down from 7 years of preparations to maybe less than a year, even half a year. It's the know-how that makes everything easier for us. And I'm sure this will also help us to go into new markets, even though we don't have a patent yet.
And maybe a good pathway to put us a little bit more into your collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that both from the beginning, it was not, like you said, it was in collaboration with the academia.
Mm-hmm.
And also that you are in collaboration now with Climeworks. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And maybe how IP plays a role into these collaborations?
Yeah, as I said, We started with, at that time, it was mainly University of Iceland, Columbia in the US, and CNRS in France. And we worked together a lot. And since then, we have worked on different aspects, and we have taken in new universities. They have come and left. And we have also been in collaboration with industrial partners. We are also, of course, working with the heavy industries here in Iceland. And it's always, these projects are all about, you know, putting different puzzles together to make complete systems. And Climeworks, for example, our collaboration with Climeworks, it came through, or we started to talk and decided to apply for a Horizon 2020 grant. That was how our process started. And we went into that collaboration with our individual IPs. So we have some background IP that we have. We know how to inject and mineralize. Climeworks knows how to collect from air, you know, capture CO2 from air and supply it to us. And initially what we did, so they captured the way they had always done, and we injected the way we were doing. And the, perhaps in the simplest term, it was just a single pipe between them and us. And then we made the whole cycle. But nowadays, once we have, let's say, gotten more acquainted to another and, you know, scaled up our collaboration, we are always thinking about how we can optimize. Can we merge the system? Is there something possible? You know, will it make it better or will it make it worse? Initially, you know, to make things simple, we usually start apart, but then with experience, we try to optimize on all fronts, let's say.
This is a good example of how IP rights, they open up possibilities for collaborations. You have your know-how on one side and they have their know-how, mm-hmm. and maybe different parts of IP rights. You collaborate to make something even bigger, which in turn can lead to, of course, we all hope, more sustainability and make it possible to upscale the conjoint innovation and solutions.
Definitely. I mean, the difference between the initial demonstration with Climeworks compared to what we are doing now, we have scaled by almost a factor of 100 since we started the first time. And we know the resource demand has decreased considerably. For just to just simple things like the amount of steel that we need to do the whole thing. It has, I think, maybe almost half. There are different, you know, advances in of different parts of the value chain, but we see that, you know, ongoing collaboration has definitely made the whole system much more efficient.
So as I see it, I would see that in this respect, with respect to collaborations, because often there's a tendency to look at IP rights as just an insurance, you know, from the defensive side of things. If I get a patent for this, I secure my rights. Nobody else can use the technology. But I think it's very important to also look at it from the more positive side, because it is an opportunity once you have an IP right, for example, a patent, with respect to collaborations, licensing, negotiations. It opens up so many more possibilities. And I think this is a very good example of that in the real world.
Yes. Honestly, I have to admit, you are more experienced in this sector than I, but definitely, I mean, it is a know-how we have, and we, of course, use that as part of our assets.
Now, if we move a little bit more towards the end of this, how IP can support sustainability. And I think if I gather my thoughts on that a little bit from the IP attorney perspective, for me, I think it's obvious that sustainability is the future. It will be the essence in every industry. This is the path that we have been going in the past years, and especially, maybe in the past 2 or 3 years. We are facing climate risks on the path of international institutions and countries. They have set goals to solve this problem. But without new technologies, these goals will not be reached. And I think it's, to me, it's obvious that innovation in the field of green technology will be essential. And IP rights will play a major role, like we have discussed, because obtaining IP rights can be so essential to secure investment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, carbon capture and storage, it is one piece that needs to be done to solve the climate crisis. And what we are continuously doing is trying to find ways of making it more efficient so it's not demanding on other resources. For example, electricity or hot water, just to take the Icelandic example, or just you have to mine different, you know, steel and metals out of the ground to make the technological solutions work. And this is just something that we are doing. We started with our process, but definitely if we do not innovate and keep on doing it, we will just be left behind, and there will be some other process that will be perhaps more efficient than ours. And then we are just out of the business. Maybe it's good to be out of the business for if there is somebody else that does it better than us, you know, in this particular respect with regards to climate change. But our aim is always to be better and better and better, to innovate, to be more efficient. And one step towards that is to always have this, let's say, good portfolio of technologies so people are interested in working with us, so we can then in turn become better.
I think that's a very good summary of the thought that the drive for sustainability is a continual improvement. It's not a box that you check. So that summarizes that approach quite well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely, our primary goal is just to make it as least energy intensive as possible. So that it's a huge thing that we have to think about. If we want to apply these, let's say, these technological solutions, we have to make sure they use as little energy as possible, because we need to use the energy for other things than to solve the climate crisis.
So as we are reaching the end of this podcast, maybe a few final questions. Are there any areas that you can still see that you can make some improvements at Carbfix?
Yeah. We have many ideas that we want to test. Definitely just to optimize. We want to be able to decrease the water demand of our process. We are also starting next year to use alternative water compared to what we have been doing in the past. So we want to use seawater so we can expand the technology into the oceans. So there are definitely, let's say, million areas that we are investigating to make it more applicable everywhere. So we are also working with collaborators in Switzerland, Turkey, Italy, and Germany to see if the technology can work well there in maybe less feasible areas, but still work. And this is just what we are going to be doing for the, yeah, let's say next years and decades, I would think. You can always improve.
Yeah, and maybe there are some of our listeners here today that have some ideas on some solutions that they can get in touch with, either Berkur or somebody at Carbfix.
Yeah, Carbfix at carbfix.com. We get a lot of ideas, all, you know, from school children and up to senior citizens. So we are flooded with ideas, and some of them are actually very good.
I should also mention that Berkur will be speaking at the upcoming conference on IP and sustainability, which will be held on November 4th, organized on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the Icelandic Intellectual Property Office. It will be held in Iceland, but it will also be streamed. So I encourage everybody that's interested to look it up and register for it. So maybe just one final question from me to you, Berkur. If you have one wish for Carbfix in the near future, what would it be?
Universal CO2 price. It would make life so much easier. If everybody would just have to pay for the CO2 that they emit, we could directly compare to it and we could show people that our solution is already much cheaper in selected industries than to emit. It would make my life easier not having to convince people that it's better to solve your pollution than to pollute.
Very good answer. I think if I were to answer the same question from my IP attorney perspective, I would say, and that's why I'm happy to hear that you are at this point at least trying to implement the IP thought process from the beginning that you come up with ideas, then it would be that companies think about IP and the IP angle from the beginning and think of it as a business tool and the vehicle to make ideas into not only ideas, but something that's working in real life. Berkur, I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for this talk. It's been very informing and inspirational. And at least for me, I think the main takeaways is that IP and IP rights are an essential component in the business strategy, I guess, for modern and innovative companies. Do you agree?
Definitely. It's a very convenient tool to frame your process. And as you get used to it, it's becoming more and more, you know, part of our DNA to do it like this way. And it makes things easier to progress.
Exactly. It's like you said earlier, it's all the puzzles coming together.
Yes.
So thanks to the European Patent Office and the Icelandic Intellectual Property Office for facilitating this important conversation. And let me say also happy 30th birthday to the Icelandic Intellectual Property Office. And finally, thanks to all of our listeners, and feel free to give us feedback or ask a question on the European Patent Office Twitter account or LinkedIn channels, and leave us a review wherever you're listening. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Subscribe to the European Patent Office's podcast channel, Talk Innovation, at epo.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Let's Talk Innovation.